End of the week, end of the month, middle-ish of the summer. So how we doing? Not great is the short answer. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday today, the 31st of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Well, that was an interesting economic week, huh? We had the Federal Reserve meeting. We had that terrible report on gross domestic product. We had unemployment claims as well, also terrible. And now we got 5.5 minutes to make it all make sense. Heather Long is at the Washington Post. Just you and me today. Heather, how you doing?
Oh, I'm hanging in there.
Good, good, because me too. So look, I have to tell you, as I was drafting the top of the show today, as I was writing it, my original draft said, well, this is the worst week in memory that this economy's had in like generations. And then I thought, well, no, I mean, the financial crisis was really bad and I shouldn't be, you know, too, you know, bold about it. And then I was walking into my little tent fort here that I've got set up next to my garage. I said, no, this was a terrible, terrible week. Worst in memory. Do you think that's fair?
You could say worst on record. Certainly the worst since the government has been keeping track of those statistics. And another good way to think about it is we've already wiped 5 years of growth off of this economy just in the spring. And we don't even know what's happened. You know, July certainly hasn't been a very good month. I think what's so frustrating is we knew that April and May were going to be rotten, but we're sitting here in July and we've had 2 weeks with rising jobless claims. We've got consumer confidence tanking. We've got the virus back in many parts of the country and spiraling again. And we've got Congress totally frozen. Like they can't even pass more relief in the face of the worst economic crisis any of us have faced.
Well, look, so let's talk about Congress for a second. Negotiations are happening, and that's great. Let's not go there. But the reality of Congress conceivably not getting this done because the two sides are unbelievably far apart, that gets us to the lasting damage that Jay Powell keeps talking about, right? With millions of people losing this government support and unemployment on the rise and all of that.
It's like they want to be Herbert Hoover again. I just think back to, we were just talking about that Great Recession, 2008, 2009. Mm-hmm. I remember driving around as an early days of my reporting career and just, you know, photographing empty houses, people getting kicked out of their homes, photographing, you know, empty malls, empty storefronts. And that's where we are again today. And as the economy is really at this tipping point, you know, things were starting to come back a little bit. The virus is back. But what do we mean by permanent damage? What we mean is, is small businesses closing forever, you know, families being evicted from homes or, you know, losing jobs and not being able to find another one. That leads to losing their car. You know, that leads to serious repercussions that last for years and years and start to hurt the long-term potential of the economy. I really think August and September are critical months about whether this will be something we can come back from or not.
Well, so look, so if you give the Senate Republicans who were banking on the virus going away and so they wouldn't have to deal with another rescue package, right? Democrats passed theirs in the House in May. Schumer put something on the table a number of weeks ago in the Senate for the Democrats, but Senate Republicans said they weren't interested. If you give them the benefit of the doubt that the virus was going to go away, what can we infer from the fact that these virus numbers and the economic numbers lag and the virus is bad, the economic damage is going to be a month behind that?
Yeah, and certainly a lot of people are watching what they call real-time indicators like credit and debit card spending, and that has taken a pretty big nosedive in July. So even if you're someone who was trying to be an optimist like the White House, I'm sorry, but all the data you can possibly see, with the exception maybe of home sales, which are booming, is pretty ugly on the consumer spending side. I was thinking about Fed Chair Jay Powell, Jerome Powell, this week. He calls it like it is, and he just kept trying to stress this line: we've got to hope for the best and plan for the worst. And I'd say July was pretty close to the worst case scenario.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Powell also said, we're in this for the long haul, right? We're in this until we are through it. has to be pointed out that the Federal Reserve cannot do this alone. For all that we talk about J.P. Powell being the most important man in this economy, can't do it by himself.
Exactly. And to be sitting here, the census has been doing weekly surveys, asking people how it's going. And I just look at those numbers. 12 million Americans said they couldn't pay their June rent, let alone July or August. And over the weekend, the Senate is going to take a nice little break this weekend while 30 million Americans are on unemployment and they're about to see a $600 cut in their benefits. It's unconscionable.
Heather Long at the Washington Post writes on economics and comes on this program on Fridays every now and then. Heather, thanks so much. I really appreciate your insights.
Thank you.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, so look, we've talked about this, right? The market disconnect from reality, that grim reality that Heather was just talking about, it's still there. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Okay, for all the grimness that Heather and I were just talking about, there was a flash of good news in economic data today. Consumer spending, which is you and me being willing to buy stuff, rose a quite tidy 5.6% last month, which is great, consumer spending being critical as it is to the overall health of this economy. However, a couple of pages down in that report was some news about the savings rate. We saved 19% of our disposable income in June. Yesterday's GDP report, remember the terrible one? It showed the savings rate was above 25% for the entire second quarter. And look, savings is great, right? For those just-in-case moments and retirement and college and all of those things. But as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, every dollar saved is a dollar not spent.
The higher savings rates are a sign that the government's relief efforts have boosted many people's incomes. Jay Bryson at Wells Fargo says saving rates really spiked in April.
Because you had those $1,200 checks that many people received, as well as, the enhanced unemployment benefits, $600 a week.
And with the economy shut down, people have had fewer places to spend their money, says Randy Frederick with the Schwab Center for Financial Research.
That could be going out to a restaurant, going to the movies, going to a sporting event, those sorts of things.
Those venues come under the category of services. Seth Carpenter, chief U.S. economist at UBS, says spending on services continues to be low. He says there's a reason for that.
The continued shortfall in services expenditures almost surely reflects the spending patterns of the middle and upper end of the income distribution.
It's normally better off people who spend money on dining out and sports games. With those venues closed, savings rates have jumped, partly because many of those people took their relief checks and just stashed them away. Now, the service sector is a big employer, so less spending there means less employment.
And less employment means less spending overall in the economy, and it can have that vicious cycle component to it as well.
Looking forward, he says, it's hard to predict where saving and spending rates are headed. There are many variables, like how long will the country be in lockdown mode, and how long will the government continue to provide relief for the economy. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
If you've had cause to walk down the dairy aisle at the supermarket lately, you have surely passed the milk cases, and you might have noticed there is just more of it. Not different kinds of milk, of which there are, yes, many, but milk brands. Kroger and Walmart and Albertsons have all started producing their own, and that's got the dairy industry really worried because those big chains are pricing their milk real cheap. So cheap that they actually lose money on it. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has our explainer on loss leaders.
There's only one thing on my shopping list today.
Okay, let's find the milk.
But it's at the back of the store.
First you walk past the produce, now aisles and aisles of canned goods. Oh, I do need pasta for dinner.
By the time I actually reach the milk, I have $20 worth of food in my basket. And this is by design. Most people buy milk and know how much it costs, making it the perfect loss leader for grocery stores.
By lowering the price for one particular product, you can actually increase the sales of many other products inside your store.
John Zhang teaches marketing at the Wharton School. He says a big loss leader is Thanksgiving turkey. Grocers sell them for pennies per pound while quietly upping the price of all the trimmings.
When you eat that turkey at a very low price, you feel good.
Some businesses' main products are loss leaders. Gas stations don't make much on gas, but on car washes and fizzy drinks. Car dealerships profit less from vehicle sales than from all the add-ons and financing. And at the end of the day, even the savviest consumers don't have the time or energy to break down the costs of every life transaction, says Jerry Smith, a marketing professor at Boston College.
That kind of cognitive laziness will then turn into loyalty.
Because we don't always want to have to search for a good deal. We'd rather walk in for that milk and know we're getting one. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
We get an email every night, the whole Marketplace team does, from our director of product, Brian Ronahan. And he tells us which stories have been doing best online that day. And there was one email, like a week or so ago, that struck me because of, first of all, the story of ours that was doing the best for us on our website, but also because of the detective work Brian did trying to figure out why that story. So we asked him to explain.
So this all started when an editor at Marketplace asked me why a particular story was driving traffic on the site. It's a great interview with a Bible expert about what the Book of Revelations may or may not have said about a cashless society. But the weird part is the host isn't Kai, and it's from 2011. So my question is why, after 8 or 9 years of drawing no traffic at all, is the story from 2011 all of a sudden in our top 10 charts? Here's how I investigated. So first step, I tracked the source of the story, and about 95% of it, pretty much all of it, is coming from search engines. Step two is I tried to figure out what queries people were using to find the story. So that's basically cashless Bible society, what does the Bible say about a cashless society, all things in that realm. So that makes a lot of sense. But the bigger question is, why all of a sudden are people searching for this a lot more? So I look into Google search trends to see if these specific topics are trending. And sure enough, yeah, cashless Bible society, starting around July 4th or 5th, like shoots off the charts in terms of Google searches. People are searching it like crazy. Again, really not sure why. So my next step was that I generalized the query to see if I can figure out what's going on here. So I just take a look at cashless society, just that. Around the same time, searches start spiking for that. And that's just odd. I can't figure out why. So I started looking at the related searches. And that's where I start to see something pretty interesting. Anytime that people are searching cashless society, they're also searching Bible cashless society. But what they aren't always searching, what's new, is Dave Ramsey cashless society. I take a look at the search results to try to figure out what's going on here. And the very first story that comes up is a Snopes article about whether Dave Ramsey did or did not warn about the evils of a cashless society. Spoiler alert, he didn't actually warn about this, but there was a viral Facebook post that was supposedly by him that says, if we have a cashless society, the government will be able to track your bank accounts and block transactions and know everything about you, and it's a really bad idea. He did not post it. It was posted by somebody else, but you know, on Facebook, it went super viral. Another thing that I saw in the results is a bunch of major outlets like the New York Times, the LA Times, Forbes, writing articles about how because of the pandemic, more and more businesses are going cashless. That kind of gets me down the line of a really rough hypothesis because I'm seeing three things. One, the pandemic is making businesses go cashless. Two, media outlets are covering the fact that businesses are going cashless and kind of asking the question, what does that mean? And then three, people are posting a lot on social media about this. This combination of three things is leading people to Google or search cashless society a lot more. And I know that when people search for cashless society, they think, the Bible said something about cashless societies. which is how they get to our article with a Bible expert that kind of answers the question in a great way, and also has a really fun Star Wars metaphor.
So go ahead, Google cashless society and Bible and see what pops up. Coming up.
This is on so much grander a scale.
Yeah, it is. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 114 points today, 0.4%, 26,428 at the blue chips. The NASDAQ up 157 points, that is 1.4% there, finished at 10,745. The S&P 500 up 24 points, 0.7%. 3271. For the week, kind of a mixed picture. The Dow down about a 0.1%. The NASDAQ up 3.6%. S&P 500 up 1.7%. For the month, well, I'll just say reasonably big gains across the board. Reuters is reporting that major U.S. airlines are pressing the federal government to renew its payroll support program for airlines, airports, and their contractors for 6 months, set to expire in September. So, Delta finished the day slightly up a 0.1%. JetBlue gained 1.3%. American down about 0.5% today. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. The Trump administration has, as far as we know, 5 multi-billion dollar deals with various and sundry pharmaceutical companies to make a coronavirus vaccine. If any of them come to fruition, Americans would get dibs on 100 million doses of said vaccine. The European Union has made similar deals with some of the same drug companies for 300 million doses. What, though, about the rest of the not-quite-as-rich-as-we-are world? Marketplace's Scott Tong is on that one.
Every country taking care of its own first is not all that big a problem, according to Peter Marks, director of the FDA division that reviews vaccines. Marks spoke at a biotech meeting last month.
In a sense, it's an oxygen mask on an airplane analogy that, you know, the oxygen masks are just deployed. You're going to put on your own first and then help others. We want to help others as quickly as possible.
But Tom Boyke at the Council on Foreign Relations think tank argues that analogy doesn't hold up.
The masks will only drop in first class, and it will leave everyone else waiting some time to get access to them.
He worries rich countries may vaccinate their entire populations, even the low-risk people, before sharing. And some countries did hoard supplies this spring, ventilators, masks, and medical parts.
This has actually been the history of all pandemics.
Dr. Rebecca Weintraub teaches global health at Harvard Medical School. She says there's an alternative model to each country going its own way. It's called COVAX, which is organized by the World Health Organization and other international groups. COVAX takes money from governments, funds vaccine companies, and plans to share the doses with all participating countries.
We can pool the investment. We can protect the frontline workforce and those at risk.
China, India, and the U.S. have not yet joined. Experts warn that vaccine nationalism could backfire. Countries left out could block exports of syringes and vials, supplies critical to saving lives. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
There is a whole lot of we just don't know yet pieces of the way this economy is dealing with the virus. What's office work going to look like? What kinds of companies are going to make it? Which ones aren't? Is your favorite restaurant still going to be there? Also, what's going to happen to organized labor? Tens of millions of people are out of work. Tens of millions of others who are working are dealing with deadly risks in jobs that once seemed mundane. And organized labor, even before this pandemic, had seen better days. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino looked to labor history for some answers.
Recessions typically aren't a great time for unions. You only have to look to the Great Recession for proof. Labor sociologist Ruth Milkman at City University of New York points out that while Barack Obama had just been elected with a labor-friendly platform, unemployment had soared.
The conventional wisdom among economists is that, you know, the best time for labor organizing is when unemployment is low.
Organizing is risky, more so when jobs are scarce. And indeed, union membership continued its decades-long decline during the Great Recession. Public approval of unions bottomed out. But in this recession, we've lost three times as many jobs in just the last few months.
This is on so much grander a scale, and that's more like the 30s. That's the only time in the 20th century when the crisis was this deep.
It was the severity of the Great Depression that gave rise to the biggest surge in organizing this country has ever seen.
There are some very important lessons to be learned from what was definitely an uphill battle in the 1930s.
Harvard historian Elizabeth Cohen says the union movement was all but dead when that decade began. Membership was, like today, at historic lows. But the economic pain of the Depression was so deep, it unified Americans in anger, especially the masses of unemployed.
There were hunger marches down the streets of many of America's cities.
An army of unemployed marched on the State House in Trenton, New Jersey, to stage a sit-in demonstration for more relief measures.
In 1933, FDR took office, instituting a sweeping set of New Deal reforms that strengthened workers' rights. For the first time, workers were granted the right to organize, and employers were compelled to negotiate. Cohen says the mid-30s saw a surge in union membership.
Striking became very important, as did the threat to strike. Workers were really flexing their muscles.
The year was one of violent labor troubles and strikes. In Minneapolis, a truck driver's strike was climaxed by severe riots and fights between the strikers and the police.
Cohen says parallels between then and now have their limits. For one thing, political leadership is less friendly to unions now. But it's not just economic calamity today's workers are facing. It's a health crisis, which has echoes of an even earlier period.
In 1911, it was incredibly dangerous to go to work in America. Miners had mines cave in on them. People died in railroad accidents. They had pots of molten steel dumped over them.
David Von Draley wrote a book about this period. He says workplace tragedies were common at the turn of the century, mostly ignored, until 1911, when a fire swept through the Triangle Garment Factory in New York, killing 146 workers, mostly young immigrant women. In his book, Triangle, The Fire That Changed America, Von Draley chronicles the conditions that made it such a turning point. In 1909, garment workers in the city, including those at the Triangle factory, walked off the job in a massive strike, calling for better pay, shorter hours, and safer conditions.
This was the first strike in American history that was primarily a women's strike.
It captured the imagination of the city, including wealthy society women who joined the picket line.
And then suddenly there's something that causes a leap forward.
The Triangle Fire. It galvanized the burgeoning movement for better working conditions and led eventually to national reforms. Today, workers are again invoking union rallying cries from the past. In April, nurses protested the deaths of their colleagues in front of the White House and quoted early 20th century labor activist Mother Jones. Pray for the dead and fight like hell for the living. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, there are moves afoot in the digital space, TikTok specifically, the Chinese-owned, much loved by millions of Americans, but also data privacy and national security nightmare social media app. Microsoft, it seems, is in talks to buy the company's U.S. subsidiary. That's according to Fox Business. And at the same time, President Trump said today he is thinking about squeezing the company out of the American market, something he actually can do by executive order. Ought to be said here also that there are lots of anti-Trump memes and campaign sabotage going on TikTok as well. All right, we got to go. Today, the Dow gained 114 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ up 157 points. That is 1.4%. S&P 500 up 24 points, 0.7%. Good for the month, too, July was, for these markets. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Our executive producer is Nancy Fragali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. Deborah Clark is the Senior Vice President and General Manager. A word here about Deborah. She leaves Marketplace today after 16 years with this production company, 16 years in which she has done, I think, every job in the shop, except maybe this one. And I know she will tell me once she hears this. But as she leaves, I have to say two things about her. Number one, it is impossible to overstate her importance to this shop. She feels Marketplace in her bones, and that has driven our growth on the air, online, and on demand. And number two, and in my book anyway, greater praise, she's just a hell of a radio producer, and she is going to leave a big, big hole. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.